Welcome to the Voice of Family Business on Capitol Hill. It's great to have you with us. With each podcast from Family Enterprise USA, we bring you the latest news, expert opinions, and insights affecting the country's largest employer, the American family business. If you like this series, please remember to subscribe and sign up for the alerts as future shows are posted wherever you download your podcasts. In this episode, we bring you an in-depth discussion on the first 100 days of the new administration in Congress and what they will bring to family businesses and to all Americans. The two guests are Karen Street, principal at the law and government relations firm of Squire Patton Boggs, and Mark Warren, shareholder at the law and government relations firm of Brownstein. Both are based in Washington, D.C. Now let's listen in onto what these Capitol Hill experts have to say about the new administration and Congress' first 100 days.
So welcome to today's podcast. I'm Pat Soldano, president of Family Enterprise USA and Policy and Taxation Group. We're very happy to have you with us today. If you don't know who we are, we advocate for generationally owned family businesses and their lifetime of savings at a national level in Washington, D.C. We advocate for all sizes of business and all industries. All sizes meaning small, medium, and large, and all industries. My guests today are Karen Street, who is a principal of law and of government relations firm Squire Patton Boggs, and Mark Warren, shareholder and legal expert at the law and government relations firm of Brownstein. So Karen's a seasoned Washington, D.C. operative with 17 years of experience on Capitol Hill and in government relations. She's a principal of her firm's public policy practice group and advises clients on public policy and government relations strategies at the federal, state, and local level. So prior to joining Squire Patton Boggs, Karen had 14 years of bipartisan, bicameral, and leadership experience on the Hill. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Mark has worked on every major tax policy debate since the Clinton administration. Legislators on the Hill know him well. He spent more than two decades serving as a congressional tax counsel spanning four administrations, including as chief tax counsel to Senate Finance Committee. He also contributed to the development and drafting of key parts of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which we're going to talk a lot about today, as senior tax counsel to the office of Senator John Thune. As we're all aware, the extension of the provisions in TCJA is a number one topic, and we're going to discuss that in great length today. So it's great to have both of you with us today. So let's just jump right in. It's been a few days since the president's come into office, and we are all anxious to hear what your impressions are about what's going to happen in the first 100 days. And I'd ask you to first keep this at a very high level, kind of an overview, because we're going to get into the more of the details as we get through this podcast. So with what do you think? What do you think in the first 100 days is going to happen? Mark, I'll start with you.
Well, thanks, Pat. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. With the second Trump administration, we have a little bit of insight given the first round. I think they've come out of the gate a lot more organized this time. And I think you probably saw on Inauguration Day, you know, it was a flurry of executive actions, orders and memos, really covering a whole variety of areas. I think he is indicating a number of policy areas that they want to work on. And the backdrop is the effort to try to make sure that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act provisions, largely on the individual side, a lot of those affecting, you know, pass-through business owners, family business owners, that are going to expire at the end of this year, Congress doesn't take action. So they're in kind of the early stages. And I think what we're starting to see develop is the path forward for Congress to move legislation that will include those expiring provisions. And it probably is going to include quite a bit more, kind of given the dynamic of the way the House and the Senate are this Congress with very, very thin margins. So I think we're gonna need to see, and we'll talk probably more later on about some of the details. But, you know, policies, spending cuts, fiscal responsibility measures, to assuage some concerns on of some members while trying to get these tax policies extended or made permanent if they can do it.
And I'll just say from the Democratic perspective, I think the Democrats in Congress are still trying to figure out what a winning message is, and obviously recovering from the heels of the last year's presidential election. Coming in early on, one of the first major bills that was put before Congress in the House and the Senate was an immigration bill that ultimately ended up getting bipartisan support. It is rare that you see the first bill that a party puts out to actually have bipartisan support. So I think that is emblematic of the fact that there are vulnerable Democrats who felt that they had to be supportive of that legislation, because ultimately the messaging that they went into 2024 with was unsuccessful. So I think you'll see in these first 100 days, Democrats, particularly Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries, trying to develop a strategy to balance social policies with economic policies in preparation for the midterms next year. And kind of in the vein of bipartisanship, in these first 100 days, we have to fund the government. That is going to be a major priority. Republicans had the opportunity to put forward a spending bill that would take us through the end of the fiscal year in September. They chose not to. They chose to go with the short-term CR that was first loaded up with a number of policy riders and then had to be whittled down. But ultimately, we've got until, I believe, March 14th to fund the government. And the appropriators are kind of working through the opening salvos of that negotiation process. But with thin margins, particularly in the House of Representatives, in order to fund the government, that will need to be a bipartisan effort. And it will be interesting to see how the bipartisanship of appropriations plays out with what is largely going to be a partisan effort, at least at first, on reconciliation and tax reform.
Karen, oh, go ahead, Mark.
Pat, I was just going to add to that the reconciliation or the tax legislation will probably continue to move on its own track, but Congress is going to have to take a break and deal with the funding of the government, as Karen mentioned, in March. And adding into that, we have had the just heartbreaking fire damage in Southern California, on top of the hurricane damage on the East Coast from last year, and the need for disaster relief funding, which is going to also add to that debate. And that whole debate is going to have to be in a bipartisan fashion, because there isn't a way particularly to get that through the Senate without the potential of a filibuster.
Well, let's talk about bipartisanship. Karen, what about a tax bill? What about when they do address the TCJA expiration provisions or provisions that are going to expire? Do you think they're going to need bipartisanship, and do you think they're going to need Democrat votes, and are the Democrats going to help?
So I think it's hard to make predictions this early. What I would say is reconciliation, despite the fact, and Mark reminds me of this, there is precedent for bipartisanship and reconciliation packages. The beauty and allure of reconciliation is that it allows you to move legislation through a simple majority. And that is critical in the Senate, where you generally need 60 votes, which requires bipartisanship to move anything forward. With reconciliation, you can move with a simple majority, and with both chambers controlled by one party, you don't need the minority. The scope and cost of TCJA provisions, as well as the cost of some of President Trump's campaign promises around tax reform, will probably push Democrats away from being supportive early on, because the vast majority of those provisions might not be bipartisan. And in that regard, I think that Democrats will try to keep their powder dry. We could see some bipartisanship if this is a long, drawn-out process. There are maybe failed efforts simply on a Republican Party vote line that create some opportunities for Democrats to put in their own priorities around tax reform. It could turn bipartisan, but it's too early to say. And at this point, I would say it's pretty partisan.
And I'll add on that that there was a letter with 11 Senate Democrats that recently indicating that they would like to work with Republicans on tax reform. It was very, very general. And I think that was an opening indication that there's at least an interest. I'm not sure that the leadership on the Republican side is going to embrace that on the front end. I think they're going to try to use reconciliation, and they may be able to succeed. It's going to be incredibly difficult given how thin the margins are. But I agree with Karen that, you know, in the end, if they aren't successful later in the year, you know, no member wants to go home, Democrat or Republican, go home January of next year and have to explain why there's a massive tax increase on everybody, because all of the tax rates and brackets are going to expire at the end of this year. So it's, it's making for some type of tax bill to have to get done at the end of the year. And that means they can't get it done on a Republican only to the full extent of a straight extension, then there may have to be a compromise.
So you talked about reconciliation quite a few times. So one or both of you explain the process where we are right now with the budget resolution process and the committees, and how does this bill advance?
That's a good point. We are too used to using the term without explaining really what it means. But budget reconciliation is a streamlined process that basically only matters to the Senate, because it overrides the 60 vote filibuster general rule that applies in the Senate. But to use it, it comes with a whole bunch of restrictions. So it's a several step process. The first process is that both the House and the Senate have to adopt a budget resolution, and that budget resolution has to identify, it has to basically tell committees for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, it'll really be the Finance Committee in the Senate and the House Ways and Means Committee, and tell them that they are to report a bill, and that bill either has to raise revenue or it can increase the deficit, and it can also, the reconciliation can also include spending, so other committees can be involved, but it gives them a very broad parameters. With a dollar figure and a date that they are to return that bill to the budget committee. And then once the budget is agreed to by both the House and the Senate, the president doesn't have to sign it. It's only a congressional document. Then the committees have their instructions, and each committee goes and crafts their bill to meet whatever their dollar figure is. So in this case, the Finance and Ways and Means Committee will have to figure out, and we don't know what the number is going to be, but the estimates at the end of last year to permanently extend the expiring individual provisions were about $4.6 trillion on net. So theoretically, if the budget committee thought that there was sufficient votes, they could say that the tax writing committees could increase the deficit by $4.6 trillion, and they would produce a bill that took away the expiration dates on all of those provisions. And moved forward. Now, there are a whole bunch of also restrictions on what you can and cannot do in a reconciliation bill that will constrain, for instance, they probably can't make permanent all of those expiring provisions, but they could do it for 10 years. They can't do anything on Social Security. So the president's proposal on the campaign trail to do away with the taxation of Social Security benefits cannot be done in a reconciliation bill. So once once those bills are done, Budget Committee puts them together, and then both House and Senate have to pass the same bill. So there can be some back and forth amending, but it's a complex and drawn out process that is not going to get completed in the first 100 days.
I think another point to layer on is as eloquently as Mark elucidated the complexity of the reconciliation process, you have to consider the challenges of the political realities here too. You have the House and the Senate, and even some factions within the House debating whether or not we should have one big, beautiful bill. So one reconciliation package that includes, you know, a lot of the Republican priorities around energy reforms, border security, possibly some issues around healthcare, as well as tax reform, versus a two-step strategy, which allows Republicans to kind of get some points on the board early on around some of those high-profile issues, and then kind of saving tax reform for a second reconciliation package. And as Mark mentioned, they have to have a consistency and in those instructions, and you can't have the House moving with two steps and the Senate moving with one. So they have to come together, both in the House and the Senate. And in terms of added complexity, TCJA was largely driven by Congress in its first iteration. You're now dealing with Trump 2.0, who's much more involved, much more engaged in this process. As Mark mentioned, he's got these campaign promises that he wants to see some movement on. And unlike 2017, he's going to be much more involved, and that's going to add more challenges for congressional leaders who have to find a way to make those promises a reality.
And challenges in an environment in the House where, right, it's about now they have a voting margin of one. You know, so it's basically going to require that this package have unanimous consent among the Republicans. So that's also going to mean that the president's going to have to be very much involved. If any squeaky wheel, he's going to have to go and address that concern or persuade that member to join the majority.
So let's get into the specifics of TCJA and what you think is possible. We're not going to address every one of these provisions, but we're going to address some of the provisions that are very important to our family business owners. You all know this. You hear me talk about it a lot. The number one issue for family businesses and successful individuals today in America is the rate of the income tax for individuals, because we've learned that 80% of family businesses operate as a pass-through entity. So they're paying a higher rate of tax than corporate America. And along with that is the provision around 199A. So what do you think the likelihood will be that the current rate of income tax will stay where it is, get extended past the expiration at the end of 2025? And maybe you could couple that with what's the likelihood of retaining 199A, which is the 20% deduction for those pass-through entities?
Sure. Let me start, and Karen can correct me where I get it wrong. But the tax, all of the tax rates in our seven brackets, all but the bottom 10% rate were lowered in TCJA. So all of those will snap back up to a higher